You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good afternoon. Greetings, friends and patriots. This is Carl Frisch filling in for Tom Hartman today, who is out sick, and we're hoping that he'll be back tomorrow and feeling 100%. In the meantime, I'm filling in this afternoon again. Carl Frisch, you can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. You can follow me on Twitter as well at Carl Frisch. We've got a great show for you lined up today. In just a little bit, we'll be joined by John Nichols from The Nation to talk about what happened yesterday, last night, in three Republican primary states, two caucuses and one primary, non-binding, no delegates allotted. But it was interesting nonetheless. Just days ago, we were talking about the fact that Mitt Romney's campaign has been trying to spin the idea of all this lower voter turnout in these Republican races, whether it's Florida, whether it's Nevada, whether it's other states that he's won, that the reason that fewer people are turning out to vote is simply because the electorate has decided that they're comfortable with Mitt Romney. I realize that that sounds like the most ridiculous spin you've ever heard, but that's what they've been saying. So how comfortable is the Republican electorate with Mitt Romney as a nominee? Apparently so much so that they were all willing to stay home and let Rick Santorum win all three states. Mind you, two of these states, Mitt Romney won in 2008 when he was running against John McCain for the Republican nomination. So as pained as it is for me to say it, Rick Santorum had a hat trick last night. He won all three states. The caucuses in Minnesota, an absolute blowout, with Mitt Romney coming in third place behind Ron Paul. He won the Colorado caucus by 5 points, and he crushed Mitt Romney in Missouri as well. Winning, Mitt Romney didn't win a single county in Missouri. So now his campaign is moving forward, and you know, when they were saying that you know every state matters, we're going to campaign everywhere, they even dropped him into Colorado, the day before the caucuses. Now they're saying that this is going to be a long race. We've always known that. We have a lot more delegates than Santorum, but ultimately what's becoming clear is that this race is going to go on for weeks, if not months, to come. If you think about it, in order for Romney to secure the nomination before the convention this summer in Tampa Bay, Florida, he's got to have at least 50% plus one of the delegates. That's becoming harder and harder. Even when he wins these races, with the exception of maybe Florida, but there's debate over whether or not he'll get those delegates, even when he wins, he's not winning all the delegates. Now, of course, neither are the other candidates, but it's making it harder and harder for him to line up the 50% plus one of the delegates. So when Santorum wins a state, he gets more delegates than Romney, which makes it harder. And he's not the only one getting delegates. These delegates are being divided between, you know, basically four people at this point. So it's becoming harder and harder. And the question really becomes, can Santorum, Gingrich, and Ron Paul effectively get 50% of the delegates, denying Mitt Romney an outright nomination at the convention and bringing it to a brokered convention, which we've not seen in decades in either party? It'd be very surprising, but it wouldn't, you know, you couldn't put it past me. As for the fate of the other candidates, I think everybody in the media is playing this up as a big win for Santorum, and it absolutely is. And last night I tweeted on Twitter, you can follow me at Carl Frisch, I tweeted, ha, 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 Mitt Romney just lost three states to Rick Santorum, ha, 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 ha. And the reason I did that is because this is a pathetic showing for a supposed frontrunner. And over the last month, you've seen countless people in the establishment Republican Party aligning themselves behind Mitt Romney, and it's not doing the trick. He's not capable of selling himself to the voters. And we'll be joined in a little bit by John Nichols to talk about last night, but I really think that it's a variety of problems, and it's not just that he's a flip-flopper who Newt Gingrich calls the Minnesota, the Massachusetts moderate. It's not just that. I think a lot of it has to do with his inability to connect on the economic problems that we're facing in this country. Because keep in mind, conservatives are feeling this economy's struggle as well. And they don't like it when they hear somebody like Mitt Romney claim that he's part of the middle class. They don't like it when Mitt Romney says he didn't make much money off of speaking fees last year, and it turns out he made $400,000. They don't like it when he turns to Rick Perry in a debate and cavalierly says, I'll bet you $10,000, because most of them, $10,000 could pay their mortgage for the year. So I think it's an inability for him to connect on these issues, and they see that as a true weakness in their candidate. This isn't about, for them, talking about capitalism or what have you. This is about Mitt Romney as a candidate and his inability to connect, and they see that as an electability issue, but they also see it as a failure on his part to connect with them. And then when you add to that just the bizarre caricature that is out there of Mitt Romney, he's stiff, he seems removed and distant from the people that he talks to, he's awkward. I think you've got a very bad scenario shaping up for Mitt Romney, and it's something that his campaign is going to have to figure out a way to plan around. This thing is going to go to the convention, mark my words, and it's going to be exciting to see. At the very least, all of us progressives, all of us on the left side of the aisle, even the center left, we're going to be treated to at least a few more weeks and months of this Republican crazy train. Which I think is amazing. And if you've noticed, we haven't had a debate in several days. And I was going through a little bit of debate withdrawal. So if Newt Gingrich has his druthers, we'll be having a lot more debates. And I think that's just fine, because the more these debates happen, the more that the American people are confronted by these right-wing Republican candidates, Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, Ron Paul, the more the president's numbers look good. And when you couple that with an improving economy, we're down to 8.3% unemployment. We created another 258,000 jobs last month. If those numbers continue, and if this Republican race continues to be nasty and negative in state after state after state, it's going to shape up to be a good year for President Obama. Think of it this way. You may not be a Republican voter in whatever state you live in, but you're seeing the ads. When the Republican crazy train rolls into town, in your state, you're seeing those nasty negative ads, and that can only have a bad effect on independent voters and all those voters that the president's going to need to sway his direction come November. Joining us now to talk about last night and the Santorum surge, or I'm sorry, I don't want to say it that way, the Santorum explosion? No, I don't want to say it that way either. I'll just say the Santorum victory last night is John Nichols from The Nation. John, thanks for joining me.
It's good. I think we just call it Santormania.
Santormania?
Santormania.
Maybe like Santormentia.
Santormentia is very good.
Thank you.
You may have a winner there. That's okay. I know you're going, I believe you're going for the 10,000 Twitter followers.
That's right. My birthday is February 21st, and I'm trying to get to 10,000 Twitter followers before that. I picked up like 200 people yesterday, about 1,000 away.
Santormentia.
Hashtag Santormentia. It's fascinating to me that a guy who so colossally lost re-election can be, and you know, you have a lot of experience out there in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
What do you make of last night?
Well, he actually got a higher percentage of the vote in Minnesota, in Missouri, and in a little bit lower in Colorado, but very close to what he got when he ran for re-election in Pennsylvania. So he's more popular with people that don't know him.
Right. Well, but, and did it strike you as perhaps a crippling blow that Mitt Romney couldn't even win two states that he won in 2008 and underperformed across the board?
That's the answer to your question. And we're talking about Santorum, but that's just silliness, frankly. The winner last night was anybody but Romney. And this is an actual individual we haven't met yet.
Right.
It's anybody but Romney. 83% of Minnesota Republicans voted against Romney. 75% of Missouri Republicans voted against Romney. 65% of Colorado Republicans voted against Romney. They don't like this guy.
Yeah. We'll be back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's gonna happen? I didn't even know that was coming. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I am Carl Frisch. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the stunning rebuke of Mitt Romney last night in the Colorado and Minnesota caucuses, as well as the Missouri non-binding primary. I got to ask you, John Nichols from The Nation, Do you think that Rick Santorum likes the word binding used anywhere near his name?
No, I think it's probably a host of words that are no longer allowed to be Googled.
So, yeah, and I don't want to get into that, but if you are curious, just Google Santorum, and you'll see who really won this race. It's a guy named Dan Savage.
A very mean man.
John, so these races are obviously a disappointment to Mitt Romney. I'm curious about one thing, and then we'll talk about the states that are upcoming.
Yeah.
Ron Paul was supposed to have moved forward, and he was going to super organize the caucuses. Why is he even in this race if he can't even pull off a win in a caucus?
I mean, this is a devastating night for Ron Paul. And, you know, here's a little suggestion for you. You don't declare yourself the king of all caucuses before you've won a few.
Right.
And Ron Paul was betting on a kind of energy collapse around some of the other candidates. And frankly, I think he was anticipating that this was going to be a very normal year in which other candidates would drop off pretty quickly and focus on the big primary states, and he could sort of sneak in to the caucus states. What really happened, though, is that Santorum, who's a fascinating player here, Santorum is less organized than Paul. He has less money than Paul. He has less money than any of the candidates. But the one thing that Santorum has is a very solid religious right appeal. And in caucus states, if they had to choose between Ron Paul and Mitt Romney, they might well choose Ron Paul.
Right.
But if Santorum wades into those states and appeals as an absolute 100% anti-abortion, anti-gay rights, anti-kind of social progress candidate, that appeals very strongly to the kind of people who go to caucuses.
And he's also selling this faux populist kind of mantra about the working class. You know, his policies obviously won't help any of those people, but he's selling this message. And I think that's probably receptive to some of the Ron Paul people as well.
You know, I'm going to tell you, I'll give you an example from Twitter. When you put a tweet up, you like to be retweeted, right?
Sure.
You like it that people are paying attention to you. Well, that's about all that Rick Santorum does to Working America. He pays attention. He retweets.
Right.
But he doesn't actually offer much. Still, when you're running against Mitt Romney, and frankly, Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul, who don't address the deindustrialization of the country, the real fundamental fears of working-class Americans, Santorum's ability to do that, because he comes out of the steel valleys of Pennsylvania and he knows how to use the language of industrial renewal, respect for the working man and woman, that has benefited him. It especially benefited him in Missouri. Missouri is a manufacturing state with a lot of small manufacturing in cities across the state, as well, frankly, as a historic union state. And I think that Santorum, you know, played a very subtle game there, but it was effective. He reached out to what we might have once referred to as Reagan Democrats.
Sure.
And he got a few of them to the poll.
Well, so what are the states that are coming up? I know Michigan's on the horizon. What else?
Arizona.
Arizona.
Everybody likes to go to Arizona, especially, you know, if you're a Republican candidate trying to stir up, you know, all sorts of resentment.
Right.
You know, anger. And so we're going to see toward the end of the month, Arizona and Michigan primaries on the same day. Those are going to be pretty big deals. And now even more attention on them. And then after that, you know, there's a smattering. There's a main caucus that comes, kind of finishes up in between. Ron Paul might actually do well there. But really what's going on is we're now headed towards Super Tuesday, that first big Tuesday in March. And Super Tuesday is going to put a lot of critical states like Ohio, as well as a number of southern states, into play. That's one of the reasons why Gingrich is staying on board. He thinks he can do well in some of those southern states. That's why Santorum is obviously now, he's a hot commodity, he's staying on board. Paul would stay in for a variety of reasons. So the funny thing is that last night should have turned the cameras off.
Okay.
You know, last night should have been the night where people said, I know there's going to be more stuff happening, but Romney's just going to win everything, so who cares?
I mean, it's so bad that I even saw John Sununu last night spinning that they didn't have to have a big margin in Michigan.
Well, that's exactly right. They're going to watch what they do with Arizona as well. But something else is going on here, which I think is an even bigger deal, and that is that the media got caught, frankly, shorthanded there.
right.
Last night, some of the major media was, they weren't even going to make that big a deal of this.
Actually, I have a clip I want to play for you towards that end. If we can hit the OMG clip, number four.
Commercial break, Wolf.
Let me show you what's going on, and I'll repeat it.
All right.
OMG, look at this. Right now, 64% of the precincts are in. Rick Santorum is 75 votes ahead of Mitt Romney in Colorado.
OMG, OMG, LOL. That's some newscasting for you.
With all due respect, that wasn't even the news of the night. Colorado was sort of the cherry on top. The real amazing thing was that Missouri result. Missouri was an actual primary.
Right, where anybody could show up and vote without having to sit around in a VFW hall for 4 hours.
Right. Now, let me tell you, with a bunch of these kind of people. But let me tell you two things out of Missouri that are kind of mind-blowing.
We've got about 45 seconds left.
Oh, yeah, that's all we need. Number one, turnout for the Republican primary in Missouri was half what it was in 2008. No, it was half as many people.
But that's because so many people are comfortable with Mitt Romney as a candidate.
No, it's not. Mitt Romney got 63,000 votes. You know who got 64,000 votes?
Who's that?
Barack Obama and the uncontested Democratic.
That's fascinating, John. I hate to cut it there, but we've got to take this. Thanks a lot, John Nichols of The Nation. This is the Tom Hartman Program, and we'll be right back after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we'll be talking about James O'Keefe. Don't worry, there's not a hidden camera. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today while he's out sick, and we hope he's getting better. This is Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. And while you're at it, go follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. I want to take a call really quick. David in Troopa, Texas. David, how are you?
Good day, Carl. Glad you're here. I didn't hear the whole program, so it may have been said that this thing about Santorum, 4 years ago, these same states voted for Romney because
right.
He was the conservative of choice. He had the label on him. Where, McCain won in the general election anyway for the Republicans. So, I'm not sure these states and the way they're doing things really matter.
Well, they certainly matter. And this cycle is much different. Much more different than it was in 2008. McCain had a long drawn out process for the time. But I really can't see this race as being the same. First of all, there were no super PACs in 2008, to keep these candidates alive long after their expiration dates, have passed. That's different this time. Each candidate has a super PAC. This thing's going to go a long, long time. It's true. Romney won two of the states last time around in 2008. He wasn't the conservative alternative to McCain, though. That would have been Huckabee. So this race is very different, and it's far from over. Joining me now, as we look at this election, we've got some serious things to consider. One of them is that the right wing in this country is clamping down on voter access to keep people of color, old people, young people in college, immigrants that have become citizens from voting. And they're doing it in an unprecedented way. And to try and make their case, of course, they roll out the likely suspects, people like James O'Keefe, the convicted federal criminal who got in trouble, I guess, about a year or two ago for misleading folks in a federal office, that being Mary Landrieu's Senate office, and interfering, I guess, with her phone lines. Joining me now to talk about his latest escapades is Brad Freeman. He is a blogger at the Brad Blog, which you can find at bradblog.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at the Brad Blog. Brad, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Carl. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. So, there's almost nothing I enjoy more than talking about James O'Keefe.
Yeah, sorry about that. I know you'd rather stick to Santorum. as I do appreciate that Santorum is on every American's lips this morning.
Well, you know, by choice, it's a choice. Uh-huh. I mean, Republicans made a choice last night.
Yes, they did. But at the same time, no, you're absolutely right. Listen, when it comes to the election this year, I know that a lot of Democrats, a lot of progressives, liberals, Obama supporters are all very excited given what's going on the Republican side, but I would caution them about being too excited too soon, because you're right, there is this concerted effort across the nation to keep people from voting. This is unprecedented, at least in the modern era. You got to go back to really Jim Crow era.
Right. I mean, the party of Lincoln is becoming the party of Jim Crow at this point.
Yeah. Oh, and that's what they're doing. And so they're instituting these polling place photo ID restrictions all over the country. These are going to keep all sorts of Americans from voting, but disproportionately Democratic-leaning voters. And once again, James O'Keefe, Cub reporter, can be Cub fake reporter, I should say,
right.
Can be counted on to put out these phony propaganda videos that misrepresent the truth in pretty much every way possible, and that's what he's done again
now,
yesterday.
Well, before we get into his videos, did you see the video that Gawker had of James O'Keefe performing musicals in his high school productions?
Oh, brother. I'm glad to say I didn't.
He's got quite a good voice. I think maybe he does have a second career there. But I was taken aback when I realized that the production that they had the video of up on Gawker on YouTube was Crazy for You, because if anybody is giving us crazy, it's James O'Keefe. You write on your blog, thebradblog.com, convicted federal criminal James O'Keefe and his band of co-conspirators at its ironically named Project Veritas. I think it's hysterical. Outfit has yet another video in their voter fraud investigation series. So that means naturally they're misleading the public. Tell us about that first video that they had out. I believe it was surrounding New Hampshire.
Yeah, it was in New Hampshire. It was on they put it together on the day of the New Hampshire primary, or in early January. And what they did
was, he still on probation?
Yes, he is. He's still on criminal probation for the wiretap plot that he was involved with down there at Senator Mary Landrieu's office down in Louisiana. So he's still facing probation for that. Here he goes again, in this case, running a conspiracy to commit voter fraud and videotaping it so the world could see. I mean, basically what he did was, in order to prove that voter fraud is going on in New Hampshire, he and a bunch of secret videotapers actually went out and committed this voter fraud themselves.
But Brad,
by receiving ballots in the name of dead people.
Brad, come on,
at the polling place.
Investigative journalists like James O'Keefe, they like totally do that stuff all the time in real life. Like, I once, there must be a reporter who was doing like a drug story once who totally bought illegal drugs, and that was legal, wasn't it?
Well, you know, it's so funny, because that's actually the argument that he makes. Oh, this is this is the great tradition of investigative journalists, that the 60 Minutes does this all the time, and you know, it that's just so much bunk and nonsense, because the fact is, what James O'Keefe does is he creates the crimes. He doesn't go
right
into somebody who is believed to be committing a crime, somebody who's selling drugs, for example, and say, I'd like to buy some drugs. He goes in there and just makes up a complete story, and then he edits the videotape to make it look like they're committing a crime, even when they actually aren't, as was the case in those Acorn videos, in which there was no crimes seen at all other than those by James O'Keefe himself,
yeah,
who was violating the law by secretly videotaping.
And so the only nut in that story, the only nut in that story was James O'Keefe.
Yep.
So New Hampshire, he does this with these videos. He says that, you know, unlike them, I released the entire unedited video to give the entire context. Obviously, you write that wasn't the case.
Right. It's not. It's a lie. He did not release, because we know that in this scam up in New Hampshire, that one of his cohorts was actually run out of the polling place because the guy tried to say that he gave the name of a person who had recently died up there in New Hampshire, And the person at the polling place said, well, no, that guy has recently died. You're a fraud. And they tried to, you know, capture this guy. That video was never released as part of the quote unquote full unedited version of our investigation, as James right. O'Keefe likes to put it.
Now, did they dress like old people for this one?
They did not. Well, actually, we don't know what they dressed like because, again, they never showed themselves on camera, as was the case, by the way, in those Acorn videos where James O'Keefe, you know, went on Fox News claiming that the Acorn people were so stupid
and over and over
a pimp.
Right.
But he never dressed as a pimp.
Well, and it took
videos. It was nonsense.
It took you and Eric Bollert the better part of a year and a half to get them to admit that never happened.
And it took about at least that long to get the New York Times to change their inaccurate reporting, and in many cases they still have not
right.
changed their inaccurate reporting.
But I assume that James O'Keefe is suing the New York Times for having that story wrong.
Is he really?
No, I'm. That's not true.
He's, well, I wish he would. Because
well, he's busy suing people for reporting about his other activities.
I see.
So here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Is there an investigation into this going on in New Hampshire?
There is, well, there should be. Whether there is yet, we don't know. What we do know is that the Republican mayor of New Hampshire, has called for James O'Keefe and his, merry band of, cohorts there to be arrested and prosecuted. And, more than 100,000 people, turned in signatures, last week. To have an investigation in New Hampshire. The folks in New Hampshire are hopping mad. Look, they make millions of dollars off their first in the nation primary
right.
Every 4 years, and they don't like the idea that somebody came in and, you know, suggested that there's all kinds of voter fraud.
Well, it does happen all the time. Haven't there been like two whole cases in the last like decade or two?
Two cases since 2000. Now, what you have to remember here,
and they've been prosecuted.
But that's right. And we're talking about what they're trying to push for is polling place photo ID restrictions. The only thing that polling place photo ID restrictions do is potentially deter in-person polling place impersonation, which is incredibly rare.
Yeah, what about vote by mail and everything else? I mean, the fact is that this is really about keeping people who have trouble getting those IDs or that move around a lot from being able to turn out and vote. Brad, would you mind sticking around for the next segment? I want to talk to you about
sure.
the latest caper that has to do with voter registration fraud, so to speak, and not voter fraud, even though that's how it's being explained by O'Keefe and his band of merry men.
Yep.
Can you stick around?
Happy to.
All right. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Brad Friedman about James O'Keefe and his traveling brigade of videographers. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back after this.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more on James O'Keefe, the O'Toole of right-wing journalism. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. As always, find more about me at carlfrisch.com. Who's going to be my 10,000th Twitter follower? I have no idea. I'm about 1,000 away. So go to Twitter and follow me at Carl Frisch. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Brad Friedman from thebradblog.com. You can follow him on Twitter at thebradblog. Brad, so we've been talking about these phony voter fraud exposés that James O'Keefe, noted investigative journalist, has been perpetrating, and I use perpetrating specifically.
Yeah.
So tell us about what happened with his latest release.
Yeah, because, you know, there is no voter fraud seen in these videos other than that pulled off by O'Keefe and his band of merry pranksters.
I would be applauding, by the way, if he caught people committing voter fraud.
Well, listen, there are all kinds of, I mean, the more serious concern is not voter fraud, is election fraud, is
right.
insiders committing election fraud. But, you know, we have some pretty huge voter fraud cases going on. The Indiana Secretary of State, Charlie White, over the weekend was found guilty of 6 felony charges, 3 of them for voter fraud. That's the top election official in Indiana.
What's the Secretary of State do?
Indiana is the first state to implement these polling place photo ID restrictions, and they didn't succeed in stopping the Secretary of State from committing 3 acts of felony voter fraud. Furthermore, Mitt Romney appears to have committed voter fraud in Massachusetts. You can read about this at bradblog.com. We also confirmed to Bradblog.
Living in his son's basement, but not really living there.
Right. He was registered to vote in his son's basement. He didn't live in the state at all. He had already moved out. And so I would love James O'Keefe to dig into that one, because it appears that Newt Gingrich, I believe, did commit voter fraud in Massachusetts. And
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney. I had Newt Gingrich on my mind because last week at bradblog.com we broke the story that he is being investigated by the Commonwealth of Virginia for 1,500 acts of ballot petition fraud in his failed attempt to get on the Virginia GOP primary ballot next month.
Well, so, it would be nice if he gets convicted on those counts, because I'd like to be able to officially call him a fraud.
Well, I think, you know, you can, because he actually admitted it on CNN that his own campaign, he claims it was one guy who submitted 1,500 fraudulent signatures. That's a lot of signatures for one guy, and it's way worse than anything Acorn.
Boy, snapped an Acorn T-shirt on that guy, Fox News would not be able to let go of this story. They'd neglect to mention that Newt Gingrich was involved, but
yeah.
So tell us about the second instance that James O'Keefe's involved in.
Yeah, well, what he did this time was, up there in Minnesota, he had his secret videotapers go in to voter registration offices, essentially, and ask for voter registration forms, and, you know, got these folks on camera to, you know, asking, do we need an ID to register to vote? Now, of course, you don't. That's why we have these third-party registration drives that happen all over the country.
And by the way, political parties make a fortune off of registering voters. Clubs all over the country sometimes get like $1 per sign-up from their local party.
Out here in California, they were paying the GOP before the registration firm was arrested, the head of the registration firm, for election fraud out here in California. They were paying $8, $9, $10, $12 per Republican signatures, and they were tearing up Democratic signatures and changing them to Republican, and paying, tons of money for signatures like this. So this is done, you know, all the time, but it's done legally all the time.
Sure.
And so O'Keefe tries to make it look as if he has uncovered some, you know, horrendous scam, but the fact is, federal law already requires, the Help America Vote Act of 2002, HAVA, already requires that if you do not register in person, if you do it through the mail or through a third-party registration, that the first time you show up at the polls, you have to show ID before you can vote.
I had to do that in Washington, D.C. When I registered to vote in Washington, D.C., where my vote barely counts, I had to show identification the first time I voted.
Sure. Well,
which was a big departure from when I was a kid, because I saw the same woman at my voter registration place in Los Angeles from 1996 until I moved out of the state in 2003. Every single election, she was right there. That's one of the reasons, and that's pretty standard across the country, with the exception in perhaps more urban areas where the polling places change from time to time. And that's one of the reasons you have so little voter fraud, because people know the people working in the polling places.
Well, but it's also, you know, the point is, it's federal law. And
right.
So we already have to show ID when you register, the way that James O'Keefe was showing people trying to register yesterday. But he forgot to mention that, apparently, in his video.
Of course he did.
Not to mention that you couldn't register as Timothy Tebow, as he was trying to suggest that people could do, without then showing up at the polls and having to show a photo, not a photo ID, but an ID that you are Timothy Tebow.
By the way, he would have to drop a knee to convince anybody at a polling place that he's Tim Tebow.
Well, yeah, he might have a tough time doing that. But, you know, these guys, they never vote. Timothy Tebow doesn't vote. Mickey Mouse doesn't vote. There's not a single vote that has ever been cast vis-a-vis an improper registration by an Acorn worker, for example, in the name of Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck. Not a single instance of voter fraud committed vis-a-vis Acorn, ever, period. Now, he knows that, O'Keefe knows that, and so what he then goes on to ask in his latest video is, well, can they vote by absentee ballot? Well, it's true, they can, and you can commit voter fraud by absentee ballot if you want to risk a felony. And that is the way, by the way, that most voter fraud, as opposed to
insider election fraud, happens. It wouldn't only be voter fraud, it'd be mail fraud too. Brad, we're going to have to leave it at that.
Let me just say that photo ID does not stop absentee voter fraud.
Of course not. And you know who votes a lot by absentee? Republican old people. All right. Brad Friedman from the Brad Blog. Go to thebradblog.com. Follow him on Twitter at thebradblog. This is the Tom Hartman Program, and we'll be back after this with more.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. It's 6 after. Good afternoon. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. Be here all afternoon while Tom is homesick. We hope he'll be back tomorrow feeling much better and ready to bring you his program as only he can bring it to you. I want to take a call really quick before we go to our next guest. Let's take Stuart in Seattle. Stuart, how are you?
I'm doing great. We talk about voter fraud and election fraud. Isn't the biggest fraud in this election the candidate who signs legislation to allow people to be thrown in jail indefinitely without charges, the candidate who puts a lobbyist from Monsanto to head the FDA and protect our food supply, and engages in extrajudicial killings around the world with drones?
Can I guess who it is?
Calls himself a Democrat.
Can I guess who it is?
Yes.
President Obama?
That's right.
Are you a Ron Paul guy?
Huh?
Are you a Ron Paul guy?
Well, I think Ron Paul's better than Obama.
Let me play a clip for you. Hang on. We're having a good chat, Stuart. Let me play a clip 12 for you, and you can tell me what you think about Ron Paul.
I want as much land to be turned over to the state as possible. The regulatory, approach to tell people how to do and what the states will do. I'd rather see the land owned and controlled by the states.
Now, I don't disagree with you on those fronts, but I hope you would concede that Ron Paul is a nutcase.
I don't think Ron Paul is
a nutcase. He doesn't believe in public
lands.
He doesn't believe in interstate highways. He doesn't believe in any government role in education. He doesn't believe that racial discrimination by businesses should be illegal. He doesn't believe that that gender-based discrimination by businesses should be illegal. And you think that he's a good guy?
I don't think he's great. I think he's far better than this Obama guy who keeps us engaged in nonstop wars and military campaigns.
We're almost completely out of Iraq, and we're on our way out of Afghanistan.
We're not out of Iraq.
I think that you are insanely myopic when it comes to this president. There are things that you're never going to agree with everybody, but the fact that you would indicate that that you're a fan of Ron Paul is pretty much all I need to know, because if you dig a little bit on Ron Paul, you realize unless you're a white male who doesn't ever leave your apartment, he's not a good buy for you. He's not a good get. Speaking of this election, one of the reasons that the Republican Party is so frantic to beat Obama is because they know their days are numbered. Their worst enemy is not Barack Obama. Their worst enemy is demographic changing, because in this country, the more old you are, the more white you are, the more likely you are to vote Republican. And those numbers are shrinking, and they're shrinking fast. So the one way that they are trying desperately to hold on to power is through making it difficult for people to vote that are of color, the extremely old, the poor, and young students. In addition to that, they're also gerrymandering and redistricting especially in the South, in a way that would make some believe they're trying to resegregate the South in terms of who's elected where. It's truly quite sad. And joining me to talk about it and about his great piece in The Nation titled How the GOP is Resegregating the South is Ari Berman. Ari, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me, Carl.
I do want to mention before we get into this that your great book, Herding Donkeys, is out in paperback.
Thanks for mentioning that. Yep, they can go to herdingdonkeys.com to find out more information.
And as a former dean staffer, I have to say it's a great read and tells a tremendously powerful story about how grassroots enthusiasm and the Democratic Party was changed and the role that the dean folks and people that were like-minded like the dean folks had to play in that. So do go to herdingdonkeys .com and pick up your copy. It's a great read, and it's got a new foreword, I believe. That's right?
New afterword.
New afterword. Yeah. It's so sad. Two of your most recent pieces that you've written for The Nation, this one, actually, I guess the other one was for Rolling Stone. This one, How the GOP is Resegregating the South, is kind of a follow-up to your piece that you wrote about how Republican governors and legislatures across the country are trying to make it more difficult for people to show up and vote. Let's tackle that one first, because we were just talking about James O'Keefe and these stupid little videos that he keeps on putting up trying to claim that there's massive voter fraud out there. What did you find when you were working on your piece about the governors in this country, Republican governors, working so hard to keep people from voting?
Yeah, so, Carl, I feel like I'm a full-time member on the How Democracy is Being Subverted beat right now. All my pieces have a general theme, because it is really disturbing what is going on. And what happened is, since the 2010 election, Republicans introduced legislation in 38 states, and they passed legislation in more than a dozen states to make it more difficult for predominantly Democratic-leaning voters to be able to vote. And they did this through a variety of different fronts. They made it harder to register to vote by cracking down on voter registration drives. They required birth certificates to register to vote in a number of states. They cut back on early voting, particularly on the Sunday before the election, when African-American churches historically mobilized their constituencies. Two states, Florida and Iowa, barred ex-felons from voting. And then now we have eight states controlled by Republican governors and legislatures passing photo ID laws requiring that you have a government-issued ID to cast a ballot, which people don't realize 18% of young voters and 25% of African-American voters don't have that ID. So really, it's an attempt to make it more difficult for younger voters, for people of color, for poor people, for those with disabilities to vote in the next election, and those people happen to be, by and large, Democratic voters.
And, you know, the first time I registered to vote in Los Angeles in 1996 was in my high school government class, and the teacher handed out registration cards to anybody who was going to be 18 at the time of the presidential election. And that's when I learned, that I could register to vote then. And just taking Florida as an example with Rick Scott out there, he signed a bill into law that would make it a felony, making it very difficult for teachers to register students to vote without risking committing a felony.
Yeah, because the new law was such that you had to turn in your forms within 48 hours or it was going to be a felony charge.
But and you also had to pick up the forms from a central location, which made
exactly.
It even harder.
You couldn't mail them in. You had to drop them off. So let's say Florida is a pretty big state. So if you're a high school teacher and you hand out some forms and then you want to do it 3 days later, that would be a felony under Florida law. And that was one of a number of things that Florida did. Florida also cut back early voting from 14 to 8 days and banned it on the Sunday before the election.
Well, the sponsor of that law admit that the reason that they did that was because they didn't want those people voting?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, before it was optional. So if you wanted to stay open, you could. And now they're basically saying that you can't. You can't even have a choice in terms of when you want to have places open. And that's the kind of thing that's going to inconvenience a lot of people. So I do think there's going to be a significant amount of blowback. But they were able to do a lot of this stuff under the radar after the 2010 election with very large majorities. And it's only now that people are starting to become aware of how the law
changed. Well, and thankfully in Florida, there's a lawsuit that's going to be heard, I believe, on March 3rd or 16th, that challenges this, one of the worst laws in the country. But obviously, as you noted, this is taking place all over the nation, which leads us to your piece. As I mentioned at the top of this segment, and we'll probably get into this after the next break, realizing that their hold on power in this country is slipping away, slipping out of their fingers. Republicans in states across the South are seeking to do the unimaginable and truly make their party no longer the party of Lincoln, but the party of Jim Crow, as they gerrymander and redistrict away white Democrats from representing areas and basically make sure that blacks only represent blacks and whites only represent whites. It's quite sick. Ari, would you mind sticking around for the next segment to discuss
your piece?
This is the Tom Hartman Program. When we come back, we're going to talk about this great piece from The Nation that I suggest you all go and read today, thenation.com. Share it with your friends on social media. And when you're done doing that, make sure you follow Ari on Twitter at Ari Berman. That's B-E-R-M-A-N. Also follow The Nation at The Nation. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch, and we'll be back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We're taking your calls. Give us a call, 866-987-TOM. That's 8466. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Ari Berman from The Nation. He's the author of the recently released in paperback Herding Donkeys. Go pick up your copy today at a bookstore or on Amazon or go to herdingdonkeys.com. Ari, your piece is just so depressing. the title is How the GOP is Redistricting the South. Why don't you tell us about North Carolina State Senator Eric Mansfield?
Sure. So let me just give you a little bit of context in the piece. So after we know the redistricting process works, that after the 2010 census, every state draws new districts, right?
Right.
And it's supposed to be based on population growth. That's how the districts are supposed to change. But what I found is that throughout the South, where Republicans are in virtual total control, they have actually used race as a central factor in terms of drawing their districts. And they've done that to try to make the Republican Party the quote-unquote white party and the Democratic Party the quote-unquote black party. So I start by telling the story of a North Carolina state senator.
Well, and before you get to him,
sure,
there's a strategy behind that, and it's not, you know, pardon the pun, just black and white. The political strategy behind that is that it's extremely difficult for an African-American Democrat to win statewide or federal office in the South. So by making it so that Democrats elected are only African-Americans, they make it all the more complicated for Democrats to win statewide in those places. And that's not because African-Americans shouldn't be elected statewide. It's because the process is so stacked against them and the politics are so racially based there. So
yeah,
they knew the one thing they could do to make sure that there's fewer Democratic governors and senators and statewide elected officials was cut the bench off at its knees and make it harder for white Democrats and women in a lot of these places to win lower office.
So there's two things underpinning the GOP strategy. One, as you mentioned, is to enshrine this system of racially polarized voting that makes it harder for a person like President Obama to win re-election in a state like North Carolina, or for African-American or white Democrats to win statewide. But it's also to concentrate the minority vote into as few places as possible.
Because if an African-American, if an African-American state senator represents very few white people, it's going to be all the more difficult for him to branch out, or her to branch out, and win higher office.
Not only that, but it's a simple math equation. If you pack all the Democrats into as few seats as possible, which is what they're doing, then you have more white Republican districts and fewer Democratic districts, because you've essentially
right,
eliminated the black Democrat and the white Democrat, and now you only have black Democrats, which is the situation we're heading to in the South. So I tell the story of this North Carolina state senator named Eric Mansfield, who represented this socioeconomically and racially diverse district in Fayetteville. And what they did is they took all the white voters out of his district, put all the black voters in, and split his actual street, which was predominantly white, in half to take the whites out of his district.
So the house is looking looking across the street is a different district.
Yeah, his own neighbors can't vote for him anymore simply because they were white. And this harkens back to the strategy of segregation that was used by Dixiecrats for so many years in the South. And that's why it's so disturbing what's happening. Both parties gerrymander. We accept that. But the element of race in here and the fact that it brings back this era of segregation that we thought that we had moved past, particularly with the election of Barack Obama, I think is just a really troubling trend right now.
Is this getting any attention in those states?
It's getting attention in the states. There's a number of lawsuits that are working their way through it, including in North Carolina. There's a lawsuit that's proceeding, challenging the Republican map based on racial gerrymandering. But unfortunately, it's a situation where Republicans are in control, and they've been able to basically ram through these maps. And with the exception of Texas, which really had the most flagrant racial gerrymandering, the Justice Department has let these maps go through. And so we're in a situation now where, unless there are future lawsuits that are successful, we're going to have a white Republican South for at least the next decade.
And it's particularly concerning. I mean, many people wouldn't doubt that the Deep South would be white and Republican for eons to come. But in places like Virginia and North Carolina, where President Obama was victorious, and in North Carolina in particular, it's becoming harder and harder for Republicans to win in the way that they campaign. It's just absurd that they would stoop to this.
It is. And, you know, the South is becoming more diverse in general, not just North Carolina and Virginia, but also states like Georgia and South Carolina. And so you'd think that based on that population growth and that increased diversity, it would be represented in the politics. But the politics are moving in the opposite direction. The politics are becoming more segregated than they used to be. And you're in a situation where Black Democrats aren't happy because they know the Democratic Party has to be a multiracial coalition. You need white Democrats and
right.
Black Democrats for the Democratic Party to thrive. But the Republican Party is 95% white in the South. So if they can just draw the districts in such a way that they have as many white Republicans controlling things as possible, they can rule for the next decade, population growth be damned.
Well, and they pursue these extremely, you know, sometimes racially charged, extremely conservative policies. It becomes like a vicious cycle, really. If old whites in the South are concerned about the changing face of their state, they're going to elect extremely conservative people who then try and change the face of their state or at least diminish it. Do you see that cycle ending anytime soon? We've got about a minute left.
Well, I think the old whites are dying off. So the question is, who's replacing them? And they are being replaced by more moderate voters. They are being placed by more minority voters. But their electoral influence is diminished because of the way the districts are drawn. And I should point out that the use of race by Southern Republicans is not just in redistricting. We've seen a lot of different things here, whether it's anti-immigration laws, ending integrated busing, testing welfare recipients. All of those things combined create this Southern
strategy that Republicans are using. Ari Berman from The Nation, it's really easy for them to do that as well in the South because of the history of discrimination. People register, many times not by party, but they do put their race and gender to make sure they're not being discriminated against, making it easier. Ari Berman from The Nation, go read his piece today. This is the Tom Hartman Program, and we'll be back after this. Thanks a lot, Ari.
Thanks a lot.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, we're taking your calls. Stick around. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. We're taking your calls, 866-987-TOM. That's 866-987-8477. 66 Greg in Bend, Oregon. How are you?
Hello?
Yes, Greg.
Yes. I'd like to make a comment about just the PR type of mode that gets used in so many of these campaigns. In the discussion of Ron Paul earlier,
mm-hmm.
one thing that was brought up was that basically many of Obama's policies and stuff aren't particularly good, but the argument is, well, this guy's worse. And
well, he is worse.
You don't have. Well, that could very well be, but it seems to get reduced to that really often.
And, well, it's because you know, it's true. You will never find a candidate. I hope you don't agree with Ron Paul on everything, but you will never find a candidate that you agree with everything on. So I think I wouldn't say that it's worse. I'd say that Obama's better.
Well, quite possibly so. But many of the things that Obama has done and not done are pretty egregious in some respects. Although overall, the other guys are worse. But that seems to be what it gets reduced to.
Well, it's true. I mean, Ron Paul is a cult-leading crazy person. I mean, this is a guy who doesn't believe in public lands or infrastructure or highways. He doesn't believe in laws against racial discrimination or discrimination on gender. He doesn't believe in building standards. He doesn't believe that prescription drugs should have a national standard. He is insane. And anybody who supports him just because he's against the war, that's not a good enough reason to be in favor of a bigot who's crazy. Thanks for your call. We've got Cliff Schechter on the line. He's a good friend of mine, and he is the host of a radio program on Washington, D.C.'s new 1480 AM We Act Radio. Cliff, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Carl. How are you?
I'm well. How's the show going?
Well, we haven't quite started it yet.
Okay. Sorry to jump the gun or make some news.
I do appreciate the plug. I'll be doing a show with Liz Winstead on the station.
And Liz Winstead, for those that don't know, is the creator of The Daily Show, so that's going to be exciting.
So she's funnier and smarter than me, so I get better into that deal.
I don't know about smarter. She's certainly funnier. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I try, man. What are you going to do, right?
So what did you make of the election results last night?
I mean, amazing, huh? I think Rick Santorum, you know, he's as much of a corporatist as Romney, but I find it interesting. You know, I'm sitting in Ohio, and a lot of the electorate here is sort of is older, an older white electorate, let's say, probably a lot like Missouri, certainly a lot like Missouri, probably Minnesota.
Kind of a lot like Republicans.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Republicans are like to be, you know, but it's interesting in that Santorum, you know, he does the whole my grandfather was a coal miner thing much better than Romney when he does the little, hey, we were in Mexico for a while drinking
margaritas. But he can't ever tell that whole story. I mean, Santorum can tell the entire story. You know, I can never picture Romney standing up there on stage going, my friends, you know, I'm middle class, and you know what? My family used to live in Mexico. Now, here's why we lived in Mexico.
We fought with Pancho Villa.
Yeah. Here's why we lived in Mexico. My grandfather moved the family down there when the country came out against polygamy. And then we were airlifted back to the United States. So that's an interesting story.
It's true. If you finish that story, it gets funny. And I mean, I'm just saying, in the end, you know, it's not that I had this conversation earlier. I was talking with our friend, I think you're friendly with her too, Nicole Sandler.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, it's not that Santorum is any less a corporatist. He's not. It's just he comes from Western Pennsylvania. He knows how to speak the language a little better and pretend he's a populist better because, you know, the grandfather was a coal miner and the whole thing. So,
well, it's really more floppulist than it is populist.
I'm sorry, said I
it's really more floppulist than it is populist.
It is very floppulist. There's no doubt about that. That is him. He flops a lot. We know that. Flop sweat, too.
But oh, gross.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But he, you know, the thing is that when it comes to sort of, you know, earned benefits, things like Social Security and Medicare, he doesn't, as if it's a lack of a better word, dumbly, I'm going to use the word dumbly, come out and say the way Romney does, it's a fraud. You know, he doesn't do the things. So I think this finally all caught up with Romney, the fact that he's the top 1% guy. He's not worried about, you know, there are benefits.
Well, that's the real distinction.
About, and those tend to be old people benefits, you know, that
right.
are important. I mean, let's say they're important to all of us.
That's a real distinction in this race. I mean, this floppulism of Santorum, at least he's talking in a way that's compelling, and people can say, I think he knows what we're going through. Without even having to think about the solution, but they can at least identify with him. And at the same time, issues that you wouldn't think would necessarily affect Romney in a Republican nomination seem to be really hurting him, whether it's, I'll bet you $10,000, whether it's I'm in the middle class, whether it's I don't have a job either, whether it's I didn't make money off of my speeches that much money, it was $400,000.
$374,000, and that's it. So if you're in Western Pennsylvania, parts of Eastern Ohio, you know, parts of Missouri, as we said, Southern Missouri, a lot of these areas that have older white voters, I think at this point, you know, you see Mitt Romney coming in, it's like what Mike Huckabee said 4 years ago, and I barely ever quote him, but I have to in this case, which is, he looks like the guy that laid you off. He looks like the guy who's going to come in who, you know, he only pays, what, 1% of his salary into payroll taxes. Most of us pay 100%.
Right.
He's the guy that doesn't care about those things. And even Republicans who are, you know, who are more conservative and crazy on a variety of issues, the older ones obviously know where their bread is buttered. They know that Medicare, Social Security, these are important things. And Romney's the guy calling that stuff a fraud. Romney's the guy saying his 15% taxes are cool and the Grand Caymans are a good place to put your money. And I think that caught up with him here. I really do.
So what do you see happening as we go into Michigan and Arizona?
Certainly, you know, I think a lot of the same thing in Michigan. Again, you're dealing with a similar electorate. I guess Ron Santorum has said he's going to plant his flag there. I'm not sure what that means, but it's kind of gross. it's like when Santorum plants his flag somewhere, it's like one of the Dugars.
He's going to bring like Santormentia to the masses, that's for sure.
Oh, my God. But you know, I think he's going to – it's going to be interesting. I think Santorum will have an advantage again with those workers, and I think this will be an even bigger embarrassment if Romney doesn't hold on, because people need to remember that was Romney's original state.
Well, it's really telling. You know, John Sununu, who I've spoken to on this program before, was on –
Did he curse you out?
No, but he wasn't very capable of making his spin send authentic. I'll leave it at that. But another example of that, he was on the news last night on cable, and he said that he didn't want to predict what margin Romney needed to get in Michigan, which is like a telltale sign of worry.
I mean, I was thinking, you know, when I was talking about a month ago, or a little bit less after, whenever, I'm losing track of time now, but after South Carolina, and, you know, I was talking to my wife about it, and I said, if I were Gingrich at that moment, the thing I would do would be to concentrate on Michigan, because if you want a big headline, you beat Romney in the place where his dad was the head of American Motors Corporation, you know, you beat him in the place where his dad was governor, that is going to be an embarrassment for him, and now the same holds true for Santorum, and again, we're dealing with a pool of you know, not to say that all voters are that way, there are some more affluent voters in the suburbs of Detroit, and there's different groups. You know, but there are a lot of older voters, like there are in parts of the Midwest, who are working class, and I think Santorum can speak that language better. And I think, you know, in the end, Romney could be a lot of trouble. And you pointed out here what a kook Ron Paul is, which I've enjoyed. I was listening earlier when you were talking.
Well, I wanted to actually ask you about him. I mean, he's supposed to be the king of caucuses, and he just can't pull his stuff together.
Well, he can't, and it makes it impossible. People always point out Gingrich and Santorum, how that makes it impossible for them to pull together the right to go up against Romney, as if there's much further to the right, but there is in the Republican Party because they're nuts. So, you know, to consolidate the right, people forget that Ron Paul has the fringe far, far, far right. His whole states' rights, what you were saying to that caller earlier, you know, we don't need to desegregate lunch counters kind of thing. There's a reason Stormfront endorsed him. There's a reason why these...
And for people that don't know what Stormfront is, it's a neo-Nazi white supremacist website.
That's exactly right. I should have been clear with people and told them.
You know, most people don't frequent those websites other than Ron Paul supporters.
I hang out there a lot. They dig the name Schechter over there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But, I mean, so what this does is it makes it so even Ron Paul, people need to remember, yeah, there's a section of people that are Ron Paul fans that are, you know, younger and whatever, but the people forget that a big chunk of those people supporting him, they're not libertarian. They're states' writers like him, which has a whole...
Ron Paul's career was built on the money... People subscribing to his virulently racist and homophobic newsletters from the Klan, from white supremacist groups, from neo-Nazi groups, from militia members. That's where Ron Paul made his money between his runs between when he was in Congress the first time, ran for president as a libertarian, and came back to Congress in the 90s.
People need to remember that a lot of that sort of McVeigh sentiment originally, where Nichols lived, was Michigan. There's a militia, a strong militia, that Hutaro group that got arrested in northern Ohio and in Michigan. There's that sentiment is there too. So I would just say people forget that's what gives the only thing Romney has going for him is, you know, you get from the far right of Santorum and Gingrich to the far, far right of Paul supporters, and no one of those guys has been able, because they're all there, to consolidate all of that against Romney.
Speaking of Ron Paul, Cliff, we've got a call from a Ron Paul supporter. Do you mind taking it with me?
Oh, I'd enjoy it.
All right. Chris and Madison, how are you?
Hey, gentlemen, how are you guys doing today?
Good. We've got about a minute left before this break, so you got to speak quickly.
Yeah, quickly. I guess you guys have just flabbergasted me. The fact that you guys are putting this bullseye on Ron Paul and throwing him under the table, I asked
There's no bullseye. He's hardly worth mentioning other than he did so poorly last night.
So poorly. Here's the real issue. You guys don't understand. Ron Paul has a holding of the people that any Republican candidate that whoever supports, they don't have a chance to get into office unless they can get the support of Ron Paul behind them. At the end of the day, the Republican Party that either one of you guys are trying to...
You really
got to
get on some meds, dude. You really got to get on some meds. Or at least go to a cult deprogramming workshop or something, because it's just lunacy. It's just lunacy. Cliff, if you can stick around, I'd really appreciate you sticking around, Cliff, and we'll pick this up on the other side of this break. I dropped it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more with Cliff Schechter. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. More about me at carlfrisch.com. And go sign up on Twitter to follow me as well, Carl Frisch. That's Carl with a K, F-R-I-S-C-H. Joining me now is Victoria Jones from Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, hello.
Thank you.
So, there was a big election night last night of a lot of non-binding delegate states, and Santorum totally surged over the competition.
He did. The Santorum sweep, the surge, the trifecta, the hat trick, and is really a sign of Republican unease with Mitt Romney. And there are certainly some signs from both camps that they're capitalizing on this. Mitt Romney now casting Rick Santorum as a Washington insider, along with yes. That's his line of attack.
Do you know that Rick Santorum, you know, Roll Call does that poll every year of staffers and members of Congress. And for several years in a row, when Republicans were in control of both the House and the Senate, Rick Santorum was always voted the dumbest member of Congress. Now, I'm not saying he is the dumbest member of Congress, but for a Republican to be voted that when Republicans controlled the legislatures, crazy. Mm. So the fact that anybody would call him a Washington insider is perplexing.
Well, his fellow Republican is calling him that because they have to carpet bomb him now. What they would have preferred to do was to act as though they were the presumptive nominee and take on Barack Obama. But because they miscalculated and ignored these three states, they allowed Rick Santorum to take them and to give himself at least a couple of weeks until the debate on February the 22nd to have all this momentum and all this press.
So do you think, are they spinning what's going to happen in Michigan and Arizona at this point? Are they trying to lower expectations there already?
At the moment, it's hard to tell. They have high expectations in Michigan, of course, because, you know,
sure.
Mitt Romney's father was governor there, and they have family history. They have pretty high expectations in Arizona. They've got a good ground game there. They have high hopes in Arizona, but it is a very conservative Republican electorate in Arizona. Obviously, they have strong immigration concerns. Mitt Romney is very part of the right on immigration.
Well, I was going to say conservative is a good euphemism for what they are in Arizona. I don't know if you heard about this court decision in southern Arizona saying that a woman couldn't run for city council because she didn't speak good enough English, but that's
yes.
The kind of electorate that they're having there in Arizona.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Indeed.
So, other stories. What's the Prop 8 fallout looking like?
Prop 8, one of the questions about Prop 8 is whether it's even going to go to the Supreme Court, whether the Supreme Court will even take it, actually.
Yeah, it's mostly because it's a more refined decision. It does say that the proposition is unconstitutional because it defies due process, et cetera. But it really tailors it to California, right?
Yes, it tailors it to California. It's very specific. They might take it, and then if they do, the question would be, do they issue a sweeping ruling or do they issue a narrow ruling? They quite like narrow rulings, so they could issue a very narrow ruling, which, of course, would please nobody. But they might do that. That's if they take it at all. One of the hot stories today is the Stock Act, the Stock
Right.
Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act, which, of course, is now in the House, having passed the Senate 96-3. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, is assailing his Republican counterparts in the House. He is furious. He's accusing them of doing the bidding of Wall Street. It's astonishing and extremely disappointing that the House will fulfill Wall Street's wishes by killing this provision. If Congress delays action, the political intelligence industry will stay in the shadows just the way Wall Street likes it. He's referring to a provision that the House has removed from the bill that would have required political intelligence firms to register in a similar fashion to lobbyists.
And those are people that meet with members of Congress and their staffs to find out what's happening on the Hill and then feed that information back to Wall Street so that people have an edge in their trading.
Exactly, exactly. And Grassley introduced this as an amendment in the Senate bill, and it got through. Now, Eric Kander's office is saying that actually they've strengthened and expanded the bill and that the provision was extremely broad and could have unintended consequences. But
he's saying that it could have unintended consequences, but they actually just said that instead of doing anything in that regard, we're just going to study the issue a little bit more. This is a bill that Louise Slaughter sponsored for the last 6 years. I imagine she's very angry that Cantor and the Republicans are not even letting Democrats offer amendments.
They're furious. They're furious not only that they're not getting to offer amendments, but they're not even getting an acknowledgement about this.
I mean, it really has been her pet project for going on three Congress at this point.
Yes.
How do you think things will shake out? Do you think Republicans in the Senate or Democrats in the Senate will bristle at the House version of the legislation?
I think when it comes to the floor, which I believe is going to be tomorrow, I think people are probably going to vote for it. There is so much pressure to get something through rather than to be seen to be voting against it, which just doesn't look very good with Congress's ratings so low, that I think it's likely to go through. Then it's going to have to be worked out in a House-Senate conference.
Well, we'll have to see where that goes. Any word on the development of the super PAC story with the president saying that he's going to open things up and let folks that are allies of his raise money like the Romney and Gingrich super PACs?
Just that is ongoing. Republicans continue to assail the Obama campaign for that, saying that it's brazen cynicism and that the president will do anything to win, to which I think the campaign is privately saying, well, duh.
Yeah, well, I think Karl Rove's $500 million is a pretty good reason that they'd actually say that they have to do this. I want to thank you, Victoria, for joining me from the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks a lot for coming on and sharing the news with us.
Thank you so much.
All righty. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. For the next hour, I'm Carl Frisch. Find out more about me at carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter at Carl Frisch. That's Carl with a K, F-R-I-S-C-H. We'll take your calls after this break, 866-987-TOM. That's toll-free, 866-987-8466. In the next hour, we're going to talk to Mark Oppenheimer, who writes for the New York Times and has this great piece in Salon about Maggie Gallagher, a woman who is at the centerpiece of anti-gay marriage forces.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom today, who is out sick and hopefully will be back and better tomorrow. I'm Carl Frisch. You can find more about me at carlfrisch.com. That's Carl with a K, F-R-I-S-C-H.com. Follow me on Twitter. Help me get to 10,000 by my birthday on February 21st. Follow me at Carl Frisch. This has been a great show thus far. We got another hour to go. Joining me now, in the wake of the Prop 8 ruling in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which found that the Proposition 8, which put a constitutional amendment into California's Constitution saying that same-sex couples could not be married, finding that that was unconstitutional. One of the biggest advocates behind this whole thing, that this whole move to deny same-sex couples marriage equality and simple human dignity, has been Maggie Gallagher, formerly of the National Organization for Marriage. She's now leading an organization that's trying to build a narrative that Christians are being bullied in this country by gay people, if you can believe it or not. The natural extension of that is, of course, laws that are proposed in Tennessee and other places that say, yes, bullying is wrong, but Christians should be allowed to bully gays. Joining me now is the author of a fabulous piece that you can find at salon.com called The Making of Gay Marriage's Top Foe, Dr. Mark Oppenheimer. He writes the beliefs column for the New York Times, and he's a contributor at Salon. Mr. Oppenheimer, Dr. Oppenheimer, thanks for joining me.
Mark is fine, but it's good to be here. Good to be here with you.
Absolutely. So this is probably the most all-encompassing look at Maggie Gallagher's background that I've probably ever read.
So kudos on that. How did you get such access? I know you tried for years to get a sit down with her.
Well, I've been working on this piece for quite a while. Initially, she was reluctant to cooperate, which I don't blame her for. If someone were writing a profile of me, I'd probably be reluctant to cooperate. And she probably correctly figured out that I don't share her politics. I think what happened was I started calling everyone she knew. I called her old college roommates. I called her sisters. I called so many people in her world. I think she was probably getting an email or two every week saying, hey, this reporter called me, and I think eventually maybe she just wanted to meet me because, you'd have to ask her, but my sense is that eventually she figured, well...
Something tells me she's not going to give me an interview.
Oh, you know, she might. She's incredibly generous spirited, and I think she probably would. In any event, I think...
We'll get to her generous spirit in a moment, but I am interested. You said that you were talking to a lot of people before you spoke to her. Do you think that your view of her changed after talking with her? Obviously, you could have probably written a piece with the number of people you've spoken to, and it's a really detailed piece that you've written, 12 pages printed, which is pretty extensive. Mm-hmm. Did your views or assumptions about her change as a result of chatting with her?
Yes, they did. I think I grew to have a very substantial appreciation for her intellect, which you don't always get by just watching her debate. Debate formats don't always lend themselves to showing off someone's subtlety of mind. But you talk with her and you realize how bright she is, how carefully she's thought through things. And the other thing I'll add is that, and this I think is one of the surprising things in my piece, maybe you'll agree, is that she's not driven primarily by any sort of animus against gay people. That is what is both interesting but also somewhat peculiar about her.
Well, I would pick a bone of contention on that front, and we'll get to that in a bit. I don't want it to detract from how good this piece is, and I really do think people should go to salon.com. But don't you, I mean, one thing that your piece touches on a bit here and there is that there's more extreme factions out there than she is.
Right.
In my heart of hearts, watching her over these years, as she stands around people that can only be described as virulently homophobic and bigoted.
Right.
As she has them on her board. I mean, just listen to some of these. I mean, one of the claims is that she's not too closely aligned with groups like the Family Research Council, et cetera, et cetera. These groups co-host events left, right, and center. And wouldn't it make sense? Because one thing that's very clear in your piece is that she's extremely smart and politically savvy. Wouldn't it make sense for somebody who views themselves as one of the leaders on this issue and knows how the media works, because she's been in it for a long time, wouldn't it make sense that a woman like Maggie Gallagher would think, I can't be the flamethrower here. I have to let everybody else do that around me. As long as I'm stoic and hold up the image of somebody who's more rational and thoughtful about the subject, I can help in that regard. And I'll let everybody else, all of my other allies, say the crazy, hateful things that they say.
Sure. I agree with you. She's incredibly savvy and incredibly shrewd, and she has some terrible bedfellows. I mean, there's no question but that she is able to work with people who I think it's pretty unconscionable to work with. So you and I are in complete agreement there. I really was just going on the word of people like Jonathan Rauch, who's a gay man and, as you know, one of the leading pro same-sex marriage advocates,
sure,
who said to me, as did John Corvino, who is co-authoring a book with Maggie Gallagher, these are gay men who have said to me, you know, I know what homophobes are like. I look them in the eye all the time, and I don't get any feeling of personal homophobia from her.
Well, for a woman, you tell a remarkable story of her being a unplanned single mother and when she was attending Yale, and how that was a surprise to her, and trying to make that relationship with the child's father work for a while, and it didn't end up working out. For somebody who comes from that background, obviously financial stability is going to be a concern from day one. Obviously, with a degree from Yale, it may not be that big of a concern. But when you're starting your adult life as a single mother, it's going to be something that you think about. One thing, and I read the entire piece, but I don't recall you mentioning the scandal that she was in during the Bush administration, mm-hmm. Where she was paid as part of their payola program. Mm-hmm. She and Armstrong Williams were paid by the White House to write columns. Armstrong Williams, I believe, about No Child Left Behind. And Maggie Gallagher about same-sex marriage and marriage equality.
Yeah, I can tell you just quickly, she didn't write column. She wasn't paid for the column. She was already a columnist and had columnized about those things for a while before
sure,
she payroll.
She was a syndicated columnist at the time.
She ended up doing some speech writing and some copywriting, I think, for brochures and pamphlets. This was when she was getting money from Wade Horn, who was the Bush administration official in charge of, like, marriage promotion. It wasn't really gay marriage stuff or anti-gay marriage. It was more like those programs to try to encourage poor people to get married. And then she went and testified, I think, if I'm not mistaken, before Congress without mentioning she'd taken money from the
Bush administration.
So, you know, I mean, what she told me, this didn't make it into the piece because it really was kind of out of the way of her narrative. What she told me was, like, you know, I'd received, I forget what it was, $10,000 or $20,000 to do this copywriting. Then several months later, I'm asked to testify before Congress. It just didn't occur to me to disclose this. I was on the record as having all these beliefs well before I ever took any money from anybody. And
well, it wasn't necessarily any money from anybody. I think everybody finds their niche, whether they're liberal or conservative, in the issues that they're passionate about. And it's clear from the time that she left Yale when she started working at National Review that she was firmly implanted in conservative thought circles, in conservative journalism circles. So it's not that she's never made money off of her views, right?
Oh, I mean, her point of view has been her meal ticket the whole way. In fact, I would take it further and say that she was implanted in these circles even before she graduated from Yale.
I mean, as a professional.
Yeah, I mean, no, this is, she said, look, I became a writer because I had to support my kid. And, what were the writing opportunities open to her? They were writing opportunities. She'd been active and she'd done some conservative, opinion writing at Yale, and she was sucked right into a very, very efficient network, that's always happy to have another young conservative, especially another young conservative woman. So it's, of course, it's been lucrative for her.
Mark, would you mind sticking around for the next segment? We've got to go to a break, but this is fascinating. I want to continue the conversation. All right. This is the Tom Hartman program. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Mark Oppenheimer, who has this piece about Maggie Gallagher, the making of gay marriage's top foe in Salon.com. You should check it out today. And when we come back, we'll chat with him more about Maggie's background and where he sees her today. We'll be back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
More with Mark Oppenheimer after this. Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom today, I'm Carl Frisch. If you're just joining us, we've been talking to Mark Oppenheimer. He writes the Beliefs column for the New York Times. And he's a contributor to Salon.com, where you can read his latest piece, The Making of Gay Marriage's Top Foe, about Maggie Gallagher. Mark, when we were chatting before, I was saying that this is a must-read for anybody out there that wants to know, you know, what motivates Maggie Gallagher in this fight. It occurred, you know, the idea that there's no animus behind her, I can accept that on its face, given what you've reported and what you've said about meeting her. What does it say about someone who can surround themselves with those people? I mean, just as an example, there's that rabbi in New York who said, I sympathize with the person who has homosexual urges, like I sympathize with the person who has desires for underage children. Now, Nam under Maggie Gallagher rarely refuted or pushed back against any of the hateful things that people speaking on their behalf said, and let alone Brian, what's his name, the guy that now runs Nam.
Brian Brown.
Brian Brown has said plenty of these things himself.
Right.
How does she make those things jive?
Well, I think she feels that she has enough common ground. Look, I'm not saying that she's any great defender of the human dignity of gay men and lesbians.
Well, you've probably had more sit-down time with her than anybody I've ever talked to.
she's not. So one of the people I quoted in the piece, a friend of hers named Sherry Weaver.
Right. The woman that lived with her for a time.
Right, whom Gallagher has been incredibly kind to and has supported financially and allowed to live with her after this woman's third divorce and, you know, really demonstrates some basic human kindness toward her. You know, one thing that Sherry, who, by the way, is a left-wing, pro-gay marriage, you know, a progressive, a liberal, disagrees with Maggie about everything, I should add. One thing that Sherry Weaver said to me was that Maggie is pure thought. That was her term. And what she meant by that was, this is a woman who actually is pretty capable of suspending her emotions when they conflict with what she seems, what she believes is sort of the correct intellectual path. And so having decided that a certain kind of conservative, Catholic, traditional marriage philosophy is correct, she doesn't let it bother her that it hurts, you know, thousands, millions of people in same-sex families.
And NAM is obviously an extremely Catholic organization. I remember what Red Report in the last month or two that talked about how it was largely funded by a handful of very extremely wealthy donors. And then if you look through the people that they employ, a lot of them have extensive ties to the Catholic Church, and it's pretty much the only church that's that deeply tied in the organization. My question is, you know, the test I always put to somebody to tell if they have animus towards gay people is this. Okay, let's take gay marriage off the table. If you don't want the word marriage so-called redefined, that's fine. Do you support civil unions that give all of the same legal civil benefits to gay couples? What would Maggie Gallagher say to that?
I think she's not, as I recall, I'm not going to put words in her mouth, I think she's not in favor of civil unions. She's not categorically opposed to gay couples adopting. She had a very interesting answer to that one. She said, well, I'm more sympathetic to it if it's a lesbian couple, because the first need of every child is a mother. So two mothers is better than any single parent. But that's not necessarily true of two fathers in the absence of a mother. So, I mean, as you
do, you think that comes from her experience as a mother who was single?
I do. She places an extremely high. She's very interested in what she sees as hardwired biological traditional gender roles.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It sounds like she doesn't accept the fact that there are women who are masculine and men who are feminine, and that there's a great variance between those things when it comes to gender.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that her thinking on kind of gender continuums and the way is not as sophisticated as one would hope.
Okay, what about these other issues? Does she believe that states, you know, that people should be able to be fired just because they're gay?
You know, I honestly don't know where she stands on employment discrimination questions. My hunch would be that she takes a pretty strong religious freedom stance, and so would say that, you know, such laws would come in conflict with religious prerogatives of churches and places like that. Look, as I said, I don't think she's anywhere near. I mean, obviously she does enormous harm through her work to gay families and gay-led families and just the dignity of all people who care about human dignity. So I'm not defending her.
I'm not even trying to imply that you're defending
her.
I'm just trying to suss out more about her.
I'm saying it misses the point of Maggie Gallagher to think that for her this is about homosexuality, or even to think that it's about Catholicism. Her husband is a lapsed Hindu.
How can it not be about homosexuality if her greatest cause in life is about gay marriage as it relates to marriage and not about any of the other things that make marriage more difficult?
Well, gay marriage is the latest battle that she's fighting.
But
let me just explain. Uh-huh. She only started fighting it right around the time that the Goodrich decision was going to be decided
sure.
in Massachusetts. She spent a dozen years before that obsessed with no-fault divorce, obsessed with covenant marriage.
Obsessed in her writing. But it was gays that led her into direct activism, yes?
Well, before she started, it is true that that's what caused her to branch out and start her own activist outfit. Before that, she'd been at the Institute for American Values, which is a kind of equal opportunity, traditional marriage outfit.
Let's be honest, though. The Institute for Traditional Values doesn't talk a lot about divorce, putting up initiatives about outlawing divorce and things like that. I mean, there is not a lot of political activism around the issue of divorce or other things that cause marriages to come apart.
There may be a lot of discussion about how bad it is. That's not true. The Institute for American Values has a ton of work around, again, work that I am not particularly sympathetic to in a lot of cases, but has a lot of work around divorce culture, single parenthood, and they were doing this work before. In fact, their founder, David Blankenhorn, was very late to the anti-gay marriage.
Right, and he's also been an interesting, he's in the Prop 8 case up to his eyeballs.
But before we go,
actually, can you stick around for one more segment? This is fascinating.
Sure, I can do that.
All right, I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Mark Oppenheimer. He is the author of this great piece about Maggie Gallagher, who is, you know, the leader behind all of these anti-gay marriage pushes throughout the country. We'll chat more with him after this break. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom Hartman, I'm Carl Frisch. I'll be here for another 35 minutes, so we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-987-8466. We'll take your calls and talk more with Mark after the break.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, your calls and more on Maggie Gallagher, the anti-gay crusader. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. If you're joining us, we're talking to Mark Oppenheimer. He has this great profile of Maggie Gallagher, who is one of the people deepest behind the anti-marriage equality movement. Mark, thanks for sticking around.
Sure, my pleasure.
So, towards the end of the piece, you mentioned, you know, that she's no longer with the National Organization for Marriage, and that she's, you know, now overseeing this new group. This new group, which primarily focuses on the idea that Christians are being bullied in this country by gay people.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. This is a woman who says that my life is a dysfunction comparable to erectile dysfunction, and she thinks that we're being bullies for asking for the same legal recognition that anybody else has in this country. How does she square that? I mean, it's fascinating to watch her that part of the movement grab what LGBT people have been saying and dealing with for, you know, decades now, and to try and claim that mantle as their own. Do you see this potentially as the response to losing this war on marriage equality? They know that it's only a matter of time before marriage equality goes away, so they frame it as a bullying aspect.
Yes, I think that the victim card is going to be played increasingly often. The deck will be stacked with victim cards, and you know, by the way, she's written about predictions that she's made for the next few years that she thinks are very, very ominous. Such as the fact that it will be that religious people who claim religious reasons for being against gay people will be treated as somehow abnormal, that they will be stigmatized. Of course, she's absolutely right. I mean, most of us don't,
you know, like racists were stigmatized.
Exactly. I mean, she really sees it as a problem that people with religiously rooted anti-gay views will increasingly be marginalized and will be unwelcome in certain segments of polite society. Well, that is going to happen. She's right about that. And
would she say that it's okay for, let's say, a Christian, nice Catholic couple that owns a hotel to deny services to a Mormon/Baptist couple because they don't believe that those faiths are going to heaven because they don't believe the Pope?
You know, the public accommodations question is one that I can't put words in her mouth about. My hunch is that she probably is fairly consistent in whatever it is that she believes, that she probably thinks that it's okay to have very thick a thick sense of religious exception for religiously motivated choices like that. So she would probably say it's fine to run a Catholic-only hospital.
Well, and then my question becomes, like, when does it stop? I mean, what religion has allowed these exceptions? Because I'm confident there are churches out there that don't believe look at Bob Jones University, for crying out loud.
Right.
They don't believe in interracial dating, and the idea that you could deny people, you know, public accommodations based on that.
Right. So, I mean, the way that the courts and law have often drawn these lines is, I think, in two ways. One is that public accommodations has a certain definition, right? So a hotel or a restaurant, something that's generally open to the public, has to be really, truly open to the public. You can't see that someone is wearing a Brigham Young University t-shirt and say, well, it's not open to you, right? If you're running if it's not a private club, then it's a public accommodation and it has to be public.
Right.
And I think the other way that you get at things like universities and hospitals and things is you say, are you taking federal dollars, right? If you are, then with all money comes certain strings, and the strings might be that you have to be open to everyone.
Which is the case we're facing now with contraception, obviously. Although that line's getting blurred, they're not very much saying that it's only because these people are taking federal dollars that they're having to provide contraception in their healthcare plans.
That's right. It's not just for people for you don't get out of it by refusing federal dollars.
Right. Mark, I want to thank you for joining me today.
Absolutely, anytime.
Go to salon.com, read his post, follow him on Twitter. It's Mark with a K, OPP number one. You can also follow Salon.
Let's take some calls. How about we talk to Joan in Phoenix? Hi, Joan.
Hi. I'd like to, excuse me.
No problem.
I'd like to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
And make a statement. I think people, Christians and other people who get, quote, married, unquote, feel that gay marriage somehow casts aspersions on their marriage. Wouldn't it be much simpler and not to have to go through the court if instead of calling it gay marriage, why can't they rename it to gay union?
Well, here's
giving the two people involved all the rights of inheritance, legal and otherwise.
I understand what you're saying.
And people might not be so offended.
You'd think they wouldn't
be,
Joan.
They're stupid.
Well, here's the problem. You know, before the discussion of marriage equality came around, people were fighting for civil unions and domestic partnerships. Do you know that in every jurisdiction in this country that had civil unions before they had marriage, or that currently have civil unions, or that have domestic partnerships, the very same people who are opposed to marriage equality were opposed to gay people having those things? And what they said was that you can't mimic marriage. Here's my thing. Fundamentally, the reason that gay people should be allowed to have civil marriage licenses just like anybody else is because when you say that gay people can't have what these people have, and you can have everything but you have to call it something different, you're putting a stigma on gay people that they're less than these other people, and they're simply not. They should be held to the same legal. So, you know, perhaps if these evangelical folks, these people who claim it's about their religion, if they were willing to give gay people everything that they have and not call it marriage, that'd be a starting point. But we're not even anywhere near that. Joan, did you know that in 31 states, gay people can be fired just for being gay?
Well, as I said, and I'll repeat myself, the public is stupid.
Joan, I love you. That's brilliant. And just to tell people out there listening, in 30-some-odd states, you can be denied an apartment or housing for being gay. You cannot give blood to the Red Cross if you're a gay man.
I wouldn't say that's insulting to them. I would say that is a case of trying to be safe for the public.
Well, would you accept that if scientists said it was perfectly safe, that because the blood is all tested as it is, would you accept that if scientists said it is 100% safe to accept blood from gay people as long as it's tested, would you be okay with that?
Not with scientists, because I have received medications in my time that when you read the side effects
oh, sure,
are
but,
worse
you know,
than
on,
the medicine
on
itself.
A blood test, they can now test the DNA and see if it has HIV or the AIDS virus. So there's no ambiguity anymore.
I don't know if they're that involved, but they could be.
My point is that whether it's housing, employment, marriage, whether it's adoption, whether it's any number of issues, the deck is stacked against LGBT people. And that's why you can't leave it up to these states to decide our fate. Because fundamentally, when you do that, you're putting people's civil rights up for a vote. And that's, you know, what Chris Christie may want. I'd like to see how he'd feel if we put people of his circumference up for a vote based on their size, and so that they couldn't get married if they were too big, because you don't want to have a child if you're too big, because that's a bad example for the child, and you want the father to be around, and if you're heavier, you have a less life expectancy. I don't think he'd want his civil rights put up for a vote either. Why don't we take Cora in Taos, New Mexico? Cora, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
I'm great.
Well, I was just going to say, I know I've heard Tom say before about, like in the CEOs and banksters, how a lot of them have a higher percentage of, like, psychopaths and sociopaths.
Yeah.
Because they're driven by, you know, their
single-minded profit motivation. Yeah.
And so what's the difference between that and pure thought? I mean, you're separating yourself from humanity, and it's like, you know, the rest of the field is, it's like you're not, you're not, you know, the CEOs and I'm sure the banksters would claim that they don't have no animosity towards the 99%. They have no animosity.
No, but you know what? Whenever I hear anybody say, I don't have a problem with those people, you know what I hear in my inner ear? I hear, I have black friends.
Oh, yeah. I've heard somebody here who calls her Palestinians, my Palestinians, like, you know, kind of like little chia pets, you know.
Right.
It's like, you know, I'm not prejudiced. I have Palestinian friends.
I once ate at a table next to a person of color.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
So, I mean,
what's great about this issue, though, Cora, is that we're only a matter of years away before there's full equality for gay people in this country. And what scares the right wing in this country so much is that, yes, it looks divided right now, but it only looks divided right now based on who votes right now. By the time
right.
the courts have come forward in the next 5 or 10 years and said discrimination against gay people is just unconstitutional, period, the people voting in that period will be people that already believe that. So, you know, you look at the generation of under 30-year-olds, 75% support complete civil rights for gay people. In a matter of no time, these people are going to be on the wrong side of history. And, Cora, I want to thank you for being on the right side of history. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Filling in for Tom, I'm Carl Frisch. It's 44 after. And after this break, we'll be back to your calls, and we'll be having some more conversations about these issues. We've got a lot of great subjects coming up, and we hope you'll stick around. Again, Tom's out sick today, and that's why I'm filling in. But he'll be back tomorrow, hopefully feeling better, we'll pick up from there. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Give us a call toll-free, 866-987-8466, and we'll take your calls after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more with me, Carl Frisch.
Closing time. Open all the doors and let you out into.
Welcome back. This is the Tom Hartman Program. For this final segment, I'm Carl Frisch. Go to my website, carlfrisch.com. That's Carl with a K, FRISCH.com, and sign up for my email list. Go follow me on Twitter. I want to get to some calls. Let's take Joe in Maryland. Hi, Joe. Joe.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Absolutely.
First of all, I want to be a little contrary to some of the prior people.
Sure.
I'm not gay, but I'm not biased because I do have gay friends, and I think that is a very legitimate point to raise. I think when people dismiss that as some sort of veiled, oh, you're really biased.
Well, it depends on what you're going to say. So let's get to the crux of the call.
No. Well, okay, the crux of the call is I am pretty much a libertarian, I'm very sympathetic to the state, some of the state stuff. I don't think the federal government should be at all involved in this issue.
Well, they are.
If I was, quote, dictator of a state, I want to outlaw gay marriage. I would allow it, all that kind of stuff. However, there's a real slippery.
You realize the only facet of marriage that the government is currently involved in is because of the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage
Act.
Yeah,
and they should have never been involved in that.
Do you think that the state should have made it so that states couldn't say that a black couldn't marry a white?
No, I didn't agree with that either. Like I said,
you think Virginia today? So if Mississippi voted an initiative today saying that blacks couldn't marry whites, you'd be okay with that?
No, I would not be okay with that. But I'm not. There's not everything is a federal problem. I mean, you know, we have states for a reason. And here's my point: what if three people consented to a polygamous marriage? Would that be okay?
It doesn't rock my boat. But I think it's a false comparison.
No, it's not really, because if you're basically saying
you want to, Hey, here's why it's a false comparison. Polygamy predominantly, and you can talk to, you know, a lot of women who have studied this issue, those are not completely consensual relationships.
They could be.
Well, yeah, and I could grow wings and fly.
But there's a lot of marriages that aren't completely consensual. There was just the article in the paper about the young Jewish woman who was forced to marry somebody. There's a lot of cultures have arranged marriage. Now, and don't get me wrong, I, like I said, I'm for legalizing everything, you know, but it's a real, I understand the problem.
I don't understand how a libertarian can feel that it's not the government's way to get opponents of liberty out of the way. Because that's basically what libertarians say. Libertarians claim to be in favor of liberty and freedom, right? Why shouldn't it be the federal government's responsibility to get the government out of the way of freedom and liberty? And what I'm basically saying there is, why shouldn't the federal government tell states in the 60s that you can no longer deny public accommodations to people of color?
Well, because
why shouldn't they do that with gay people in the 2010s?
On these hard issues, I mean, the gay issue is actually a lot harder, actually, than the racial issue. The racial issue is the easier one.
Well, it is for you now, but it was just as difficult in the 1960s.
No. I'm saying, from a libertarian standpoint, I think there's a legitimate for a private owner to say he can have anybody he wants. If he wants to have only gay people come into his place, fine. If he wants to have only black people come into his place, fine. If he doesn't want to have white people come in, fine. If it's a private establishment, I think that's.
No, but they're,
you know, maybe
they're
not cool,
no,
but
they are allowed to do that if they're a private club, okay?
No, they're not.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
There's no, the private club, yes, but I said private establishment.
Well,
club. So a
public accommodation. If you own a restaurant, you shouldn't be able to tell a person of color that they cannot eat in your restaurant, and you shouldn't be able to tell a gay person they can't eat in your restaurant.
Well, I mean, that's not a libertarian point of view.
I know, and that's why libertarians are freaking bonkers.
No, but you don't have to get into insults here.
Well,
but,
I'm not insulting you. I'm insulting your philosophy.
Well, I'm
because you're
just saying,
frankly, and I've enjoyed our conversation. Your philosophy is an insult to the American people.
Why?
What? Okay, here's what I love about libertarians, and this is, the libertarian philosophy. The idea that if the free market had its work and was able to work freely, that eventually discrimination would have been stomped out in the South. We all know that's a bunch of baloney. Alabama had a voter initiative to remove the segregation stuff from its constitution, only passed by 52%, not even 10 years ago. So what libertarians would actually say in 1964 is that, hey, person of color, hey, lunch counter protester, we are against discrimination against you, but we don't want the feds to step in and do anything. You're going to have to spend the next 50 years of your life and your children's life trying to convince people that discrimination is bad so that you can live in freedom in Alabama. And that is heartless and bonkers. I would rather protect the freedom of those people to attend or have lunch wherever they want to or live wherever they want to than the freedom of a bigot to persecute another individual. And that's where I come down on this. And I realize that libertarians love to feel better than everybody because they're socially more liberal than conservatives and more conservative economically than liberals. But for me, it's a wash. And all the libertarian magic dust in the world is not going to convince me otherwise. We're at this point of the show where we're wrapping up. Maybe I'll have to write a column about this. You can find my columns at carlfrisch.com. I want to thank Jacob and Louise and everybody on Tom Hartman's team for making today a breeze. Tom's been out sick the last 2 days. Hopefully he'll be back tomorrow and feeling much better. More about me, carlfrisch.com. Follow me on Twitter. You can find out when I'm filling in for Tom or Stephanie Miller or anybody else that I fill in from time to time. You can join my email list to find that out and follow me on Twitter. I post updates regularly as well on Facebook and YouTube. I've really appreciated the great calls we've had today. I've appreciated the messages I've received over Twitter and over email these last 2 days. And I've appreciated the opportunity to sit in Tom's chair, which is a big chair to fill. It's not that big, but it's a big chair metaphorically to fill. This is the Tom Hartman Program, filling in for Tom. I'm Carl Frisch signing out, and he'll be back tomorrow.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.